Welcome to the Self-Publishing School Podcast. This is the podcast to listen to if you're an aspiring writer or an author who wants to be more successful. On this show, you'll learn how to write and launch a book successfully, all from the top authors and people just like you who are doing it at the highest level. I'm your host, Chandler Volt, the founder of Self-Publishing School, the author of the book called Published, and the CEO of selfpublishing.com. For free training on how to publish a book that sells 10,000 copies, go to selfpublishing.com/free training. Hey, Chandler Bolt here, and joining me today is Sean Cannell. Sean, he's been on the podcast before. He's a great friend, legendary entrepreneur. He's an international speaker, coach, and the author of the book called YouTube Secrets. His mission is to help 10,000 purpose-driven people create a full-time living with YouTube. He's the CEO of Think Media and the host of the Think Media podcast. He's got wildly popular YouTube channels. You've probably seen them. They've got over 2 million subscribers, and his videos have been viewed over 150 million times. And the thing about Sean is the numbers are almost always outdated because he's grown so fast. There's probably way more than that now. He went from, hey, six figures as a tech YouTuber to building an eight-figure online education company today. Now, you may remember his episode 94. Check it out if you haven't already. In that episode, we talk about YouTube secrets. We talk about using YouTube to sell 2,000 copies a month and getting over 1,000 reviews on your book. So if you want to learn about that stuff, check out that episode. This episode, we're going to go in depth on doing a second edition, update and revise edition. Should you do it? Should you not? Over 3,100 reviews. So if you're doing some back of the napkin math, I mean, over 2,000 reviews in the last 2 years or something, whatever that is, multiple a day, like five a day. So the book's just doing crazy well. He's going to share the numbers. He's going to go under the hood. What's working? What's not? We got a lot to cover. Sean, what's up, man?
Chandler, so fired up. Thank you for having me back on the podcast. So grateful for you and your community and everything I've learned from you. And fired up to talk about books.
So I guess let's start here. Like, why books? Like, why is this book such a, and books in general, such a big part of your brand and your business?
Yeah, I personally, I love books for so many reasons. I think first that I personally love books. I love physical books. I buy a lot of books. I read as many as I can. I usually buy more than I could read, but they're meaningful to me because I like supporting authors. Even if I get one idea off one page, I sometimes just look at the table of contents. I'll read one chapter and I'll get one idea and I'll be like, for sure, that was worth $20 or $13. I believe that lifelong leaders are lifelong learners. And so leaders are readers. I'm always reading. I like fiction books too, but I usually lean in that self-help world. You know, years ago, I wrote a book, YouTube for Churches, ebook only. But even before that, I wrote a really pretty terrible book, but I uploaded it just on Kindle, and it was called Get Noticed, and it was just like 20 pages. But I dipped my toes into things. But what I learned is that it was so transformational. It forced me to really learn business, you know, cross the T's, dot the I's, get your account set up, upload cover art. And then fast forward to today and YouTube Secrets second edition, and there it's all compounding under the same listing on Amazon, is that 110,000 copies sold between physical book, ebook, audiobook. And I know it's similar to what you teach, but understanding the power of a framework and having a proprietary process, you have an unfair advantage over other people that you could call competitors or in the industry if you've taken the time to not just make your information or your tips or your advice random, but you've brought organization to them. So as a content creator, basically by trade, a video creator, a video podcast creator, having the book foundationally has just made me a better teacher of the message I want to get across. It's made me a better communicator in refining my ideas. And by just going through the process, it's made me better on podcasts. It's made me more articulate because I had to sit down and do the hard work of consolidating, refining ideas, but the benefits beyond the money or the business growth or the impact or all of that, even just personal growth. And that's one of my obsessions, is just a lifestyle of personal growth. I want to master my material. So as one who loves to teach and wants to be a teacher, man, I'll write a book just if it was only for me and it never went out, because once I'm done with the process, now a better teacher. That'll have its own benefits. But the ancillary benefits, of course, of the brand lift, the influence, the potential money are never ending. So I think that writing a book is one of the absolute most powerful things you could do for 68 different reasons. And that's why I love books.
I love it. And like you said, I love to read books and I buy a lot more books than I'm able to read. I'm like, man, I feel so seen. And I'm sure there's so many people listening or watching right now who are like, yeah, that's me. 110,000 books. It's pretty incredible. Last time we spoke, you were at about 65,000 copies sold. And I want to say that was early 2020, if I'm not mistaken. It's almost double that, your sales volume in the last few years. When did you first publish that book?
So it first came out August 16th, 2018. We've also learned some things, like listing on Amazon is the second edition, but in order to like not disrupt the reviews and whatnot, you know, because it's also Create Space or whatever it's called for the book and the ebook, we just uploaded a new version.
Yeah.
Layered it over the original one, right? Basically.
Yeah.
And so it says paperback August 16, 2018, even on the header. And we just kind of had to accept that what we did was we did this strip across the front to try to also keep the cover the same, but we really worked on the cover to make it updated second edition visually. And I also learned from studying the 4-hour work week that Tim Ferriss seemed to have done the same thing. He had a new revised and expanded edition that had a similar strip to it. But the original year was still there. So all that to say is now then page count went up and then we could change the description. So it says new and expanded in the description. If somebody's like studying the listing, they can see those things. We've also actually been having a tech difficulty where the ebook has this new strip and the audiobook does as well, but the physical book's actually the original cover. And we have not been able to fix that. People are getting the second edition, but they don't necessarily see it saying it's the updated second edition. Anyways, some of the things we've been working through, but nevertheless, 2018 and then relaunched, I think 2021 maybe, or at the end of 2020. Mm-hmm. And again, it just kind of kept going on the same momentum, but layered on top of the original one with the second edition and rewrote all stats or updated stats and kind of an overhaul of all chapters, deleted an entire chapter that was irrelevant, added 3 new chapters, made sure everything was current, updated some of the links and the call to actions and bios and current information. And so it was it wasn't just a few band-aids. It was nowhere near as intense of having to write the first edition, but it was definitely a good effort to make the second edition something substantive and truly updated and fresh.
I love that you went straight into some of the logistics, because I feel like that's something that people will ask about and people have asked about, because we're big proponents of a relaunch. You know, I think that everyone should relaunch their book, but then people have so many questions like, do I do a new listing? Do I do an existing listing? Like, how do you navigate that process? So can you speak to, for yourself, I'm assuming the why was because you had a ton of reviews and you wanted to keep the reviews on the listing.
I don't understand fully, like maybe the Amazon algorithm. But I know we're doing our own like content marketing, or however we tell people about the book, like you teach, like we try to just continue to, like, when possible, let people know about the book. But there's also Amazon's a search engine, and there's a level of ranking, or you hope to be showing up and surfacing if somebody looks for information. There's also the momentum in the reviews and maybe the correlation of it being suggested next to other books. We also do invest into our Kindle advertising, and we just try to go to a break-even ROI of, like, we end up at like 1.1 or just 1 or 1.2 return on ad spend, simply because we just want to get the book in people's hands. And of course, there's the brand lift in our backend business, as you teach. So all of that to say is we wanted to compound that momentum. So we did think, okay, fresh listing, that solves the whole cover issue. It solves, you know, it could say second edition big and bold, because there was some limitations. Maybe these are overcomable, but there's some limitations where we couldn't change the title as it's listed on Amazon,
right,
or the publish date, if we wanted to keep all of those reviews and whatnot, and not disrupt that. And so we debated endlessly. I'm talking for months. And so maybe... But wanting to say, okay, what is our best case scenario? And so keeping the momentum of the ranking, the same listing, the same reviews, the same whatever, but then saying, okay, what are the changeable things And there's still some stuff we're working on because you could probably speak to what it's called. There's now where people have the cool graphics.
Like A plus content. Yeah.
A plus content. Like, I don't know if because of the age of the listing, we maybe just need to, there's some even more like house cleaning we should do on the listing. That's not on our listing page right now.
Yeah. Interesting.
But we realized like we could take the editorial reviews place and update that. If we could do A plus, we could go back. So, because of course, then we also want people not to be confused to think, well, I don't want to buy the old edition. I want to buy the new one. Mm-hmm. So yeah, all of these things. And so I'm going to do another sweep and work with our team as well. But you know, it's also like nuanced things I'm looking at, like during editorial reviews, we didn't even get our reviews in the front cover of the book. But what we realized was, do they even matter if they're there? I mean, maybe once the person gets there, they open it up and it builds it. But they already have the book if they bought it or they're there. Exactly. Maybe they're previewing it. But we were able to still consistent got reviews after once the book was out, and we could update our Amazon listing as we had, you know, Shalene Johnson or Pat Flynn gave us some feedback about the book. So I know that sometimes people maybe feel a deadline to get if somebody else endorses it. Maybe it's just another professional at work or somebody that isn't necessarily known, but gives the book credibility. I think the opportunity of optimizing that listing and being thoughtful about that, there's a lot of nuances. And I know you guys are the experts. And so I even as being on this conversation, I'm now like, oh, we got some work to do. I want to get some A-plus content going. But yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. I love that you're breaking down all the logistics too. The A-plus content, that's big, especially if you guys can get that. It should be super simple to get it approved. You might have to reach out to Amazon manually, assuming that you create the A-plus content in the format that matches theirs. Mm-hmm. What, I guess looking back, are you glad that you did the same listing? If you were to go back, would you do it differently? What's your take on that, knowing what you know now?
I am. I guess because of the momentum, like I'm frustrated at this exact moment that the physical book does not have this yellow strip if people are watching on video. Yeah. It just has the original cover. However, it doesn't seem to be slowing down sales. And then I'm always like, I'll like order one and just to make sure. And I'm like, oh, cool. People are getting the second edition. That's the only thing they're getting. And then this ends up shipping to their house. Then I just went to like most recent reviews and great, you know, June 21st at the time of recording this, within the last couple of weeks, great details on illustrations to master YouTube, full of motivation. Of course, just like anybody too, to encourage listeners, we get plenty of negative reviews as well here and there. You never please everybody. But seeing that the reviews are still coming in, the book sales are still coming in, and it's all compounding on one giant listing. The 3,191 reviews is insane. It's kind of interesting really too. Goodreads superimposes in some cases on the Amazon listing. I don't know if I don't know. I don't always see it, but like 1,438 ratings and a 4.0 on Goodreads, whatever. So anyways, yeah, in hindsight, I still would have done it because I guess the idea is like this one asset, building it up as big as possible. But if I only know that one path, so I'm not sure what the other path would have been like. So
yeah. Well, and it's interesting. I mean, I republished my book as well, and I also did the same listing, and I ran into similar limitations. It's interesting on your ebook. I don't know if you unpublished and republished, but your pub date on your ebook says May 2nd, 2022, which is obviously the most recent pub date. But then
there you go.
Then you're right. On the paperback, it says 2018, which and there's a couple of the things that like for me, I'm like, oh man, that part's kind of frustrating because it's like if someone goes to this listing, they're like, oh, am I in the wrong place? Is this an old book? But I agree with you. I think everything else kind of outweighs that where it's all right, there's so much social proof. There's literally thousands of reviews. So let me ask you specifically to the audiobook. Did you re-record the audiobook? Did you keep the same listing for the audiobook? Like, how did you treat that?
Yeah, re-recorded it. And was also kind of pumped because it was definitely better the second time. Benji, my co-author, we kind of switched up the cadence. He recorded the original part and he had just broken his collarbone during like a tough mutter and fallen off a 2-story equivalent thing and was in like intense pain while he was recording it. And, so we both now at least had one under our belt and had it. So I think it came out better. And then also the book was also just generally superior. And the way we did it, I think that, yeah, I'm sure you teach all kinds of different ways, depending on maybe just outsourcing the audio, doing it with a USB mic at home or something like that. But we went back to the same place, which was a studio in Seattle with a tech that sits on the other side of the sound booth and would also kind of coach you through and be like, you could have hit that better, or you stumbled a word there, or, and they try to make it pretty clean. And because once we'd already tasted the scale of this, that did run us about $1,000 to $1,500. But we realized, okay, well, this also, it's investment in the excellence of the final product of the book itself. And so, yeah, a fresh audiobook. And then as you can also see, I think with that listing, that one was also, it's got the updated second edition thing to it. It's got the updated description about it. It's also a little bit longer and absolutely essential that we would, because it wasn't even just, I know some people's second editions, people who I love, like a John Maxwell or whatever, sometimes you get like a new chapter, but in some cases it's like, there's nothing different. It's like a fresh cover, you know, whatever, because this was related to, and that's also though timeless information a lot of times, because leadership or something. So maybe it's an illustrations thing. We definitely had enough significant changes that it necessitated a re-record in our opinion. And so, yeah, we did a re-record.
Cool. Love it. I want to circle back on the audiobook stuff a little bit later in the episode and go deep on audiobook specific, but I guess maybe like, let's just back up a little bit for you. Why'd you even relaunch this book? Like, what was the thought process behind saying, hey, I want to do a second edition. I want to relaunch and make this a big thing.
The first book was still strong with the seven C's of YouTube success, because it was, the goal was to make a timeless framework, and it has remained timeless, which is crazy in social media, but that was important. I think though enough had happened from 2018 to, as you said, 2022, because I think the Kindle date is accurate. So May 2022. So 4 years. So we got a good, it's probably more like 3 years, because it was the end of 2018. So we had 3 years of quite the run. And our last episode talked about all those lessons, right? And I think it was seeing like, okay, this might, it'll still be good, but will it just kind of be on a decline? Or could we just repin it basically to the top in terms of the promise of excellence, in terms of it's how current it is? And some of the positioning, the language we started using was like dominate the next decade. So we also were trying to be thoughtful about giving the book a lifespan. Like, this is the information you need to dominate the next decade on YouTube. Perhaps an overpromise, but also knowing our industry, because who knows what's going to happen over the next decade. Elon Musk probably will have us Neuralink chips. We'll be in a holodeck. Video won't be relevant. I don't know. But there was enough things, specifically YouTube Shorts was very significant, was a shift. And then a little bit of maybe how the algorithm works. And I think also just obsession with excellence. The first one was excellent, but there was enough that had changed. Even our bios, I was a completely different bio in the sense of much more eight figures or more, you know, brand positioning. So all the reasons you would teach us to all write books, there was already some positioning, but it was even better. There was new levels of credibility, new levels. And if your book is a business card, after 3 years, there was a reason enough to like do a reprint of your business cards. A lot harder than that, but like a reprint of like, okay. And then it was the idea that we know how painful this is. It'll be less painful than the first time. But with the ROI over what happened over the last 3 years, if we could get another 3 years on that, are you kidding? We definitely do it. And I think it'll certainly last longer. I don't know if there'll be a third edition, but if there was, then that would be a 2025 thing. Hey, why not?
Love it. Well, guys, if you want to go more in depth, you know, the last episode, episode 94, check it out. We talk about the power of timeless frameworks. And so Sean just alluded to that. But writing a book that lasts rather than just a technical book that gets outdated. We also talked about the mistake a lot of authors make. They think way too much about the book launch and not enough about continued book marketing and kind of how Sean's approached that. We talked about using your book as a sponsor for your YouTube videos, for your podcast episodes, and then the audiobook stuff. So we're not going to rehash all that here. Check out that episode if you want to kind of double click on those things. I want to talk about the launch of the second edition, Sean. Did you was it a big thing? Did you just kind of put it out? Like, how did you approach that launch? And what were maybe the top two or three things that you focused on with the relaunch itself?
Man, I feel like on the one hand, I think we're sitting here talking about, you know, you can talk about the numbers. The book has been very successful. On the other hand, I feel like I failed both launches. And by failed both launches, meaning like a launch week, rallying, even doing a good job of like getting friends to share or anybody I knew, you know, but saying that, but I think this has probably become my ethic is that I know so many authors think about a launch week, but it's much more of like a launch lifestyle is the way I think about it. And so that has been much more of what we've done. And I think part of it was uploading it, waiting, and then even thinking about some things like if there's backstock, because Amazon prints ahead, because the pace of your book might be how many they have on stock potentially. So do we even know if people are getting the second edition if they order the physical copy? Well, if we don't know, then when? So just like weird little hesitations, and then just the natural busyness. That's the reason I would say I failed is because I did not create, I would argue, adequate margin to focus only on this. But I think that's also maybe very realistic and relatable. Got a 2.5-year-old, got an 8-month-old. That first baby was right there during this. Got a business, another baby to raise that's more like a toddler that's then a teenager or whatever. I mean, I guess we're year 7 in business. So kid's crazy, you know, he's lighting stuff on fire and he's running around. And so this guy, you got other stuff to do. So I definitely know that for any author, you will go to bed every night knowing there was another 100 things you could have done to, if you will, get your book out. But if you just do something,
yeah,
they'll be overwhelmed by all the things, but do something. And therefore, and then one of the things that has been helpful is building an email list or building a platform of any kind is the ultimate asset. So there was like the thoughtful of doing like a 4-part series on the podcast, like part, you know, that was like, and you know, the and still doing what people could study more in the last episode would be like, hey, this episode's brought to you by YouTube Secrets Second Edition. It's out now. So then our own platforms. And then I did go, what I suppose I observe some authors, if they've got the connections or they work with some PR or something, they compound all of their guest podcasts all in a week. I've never pulled that off, but I went on different podcasts over 6 months and we're maybe kind of tapering down now, but I've been set, like probably since then. So since May 2nd, 2022, which if this is June 7th, 2022, then it's actually been a year. So I've been trying to do the Chandler Bolt 1-year book launch.
Hey, Chandler Bolt here. And joining me today is Noah St. John. Noah is recognized as the father of affirmations. And the mental health coach to the stars. He's worked with Hollywood celebrities, 7- and 8-figure company CEOs, professional athletes, top executives, elite entrepreneurs. He's famous for helping his coaching clients make more in 12 weeks than they did in the previous 12 months, which I've got some questions about, and we're going to find out how on this episode, which is pretty exciting. And we were just talking right before this, he's published 22 books, or I guess book number 22 coming out. And will have came out by the time this episode goes live, which is pretty nuts. Traditionally publishing experience, self-published experience. So both sides of the aisle, we'll be able to learn from both. I'm excited for this conversation. Noah, welcome. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Chandler. Great to be here.
So I guess first off, I mean, 22 books, obviously books are a big part of your business and a big part of, you know, your brand and all that stuff. Why books? Why is that such a big part of what you do?
You know, it's so funny. One of my very first memories is in kindergarten when I was playing with blocks and I was playing with blocks of letters. Now, you're probably too young. They probably didn't have this when you were in kindergarten or whatever. But when I was in kindergarten, they had these blocks of letters, you know, learn your ABCs, ABC. And, you know, just so one of my first earliest memories is taking these blocks of letters and just making these long, long words. I always loved words. And I started reading before I was 2 years old. You can ask my mother this. She's a teacher. And my aunt was a teacher. So I grew up with, you know, teachers and the arts and things like that. Lots of creative people. Both my parents and everybody that I grew up with were very creative people. So I always loved books. I loved reading and I loved learning. And another part of my story is that I grew up poor in a rich neighborhood. And I know that's a total cliche, but it's true. I grew up in a little town called Kennebunkport, Maine, which is one of the wealthiest communities in New England.
Oh, yeah.
My family was dirt poor.
It's a great place.
Exactly. Well, my family was dirt poor. I mean, that literally. We lived at the bottom of a dirt road in a drafty, unfinished house that my parents ended up losing to foreclosure when I was just 15 years old. So I hated being poor because I saw that right down the street, there's great wealth and abundance. So I literally said from the time I was a little kid, how the heck do I get from here to there? Mm-hmm. And the only thing that I could figure to do was go to the library and start reading books.
Mm-hmm.
Internet back then, you know, so there was no YouTube or things like that. So I went to the library. So I basically grew up in the library. I grew up around books. And as you can see now from my, you know, library behind me, these are some of the 22 books that I've written here. And these are some of my books in other languages, 18 languages now.
Oh, wow.
So I've just always been surrounded by books. I love books and, you know, I love writing. And so that is, I know I'm really weird because a lot of authors don't like those two things.
You
know? Yeah.
Yeah.
But I love the process of writing. I love the doing of the writing. I was listening to an interview with John Grisham and he had a great quote that I remember. He said, you know, writing books is really easy. It's selling them that's hard. You know, and I'm like, I hear you, buddy. I hear you, brother. So anyway, I love books and that's why I did it.
So you talked about writing books is easy, at least for you. But selling them is hard. So yeah. How have you been so successful with your books? Like, how have you sold so many copies of your books? Let's start there.
Well, you know, I'll never forget my very first book that was published in 1999. All right. So almost 25 years ago now, and actually it was self-published in 1998. So which is 25 years ago right now. Back then in 1998, you remember being online in the 90s for the folks listening and watching the program, right? Remember the, you know, right. And I mean, it was bad. You know, it was basically just me and Al Gore back then. So it was like trying to build a little internet humor for you there. Anyway. Anyway, it was like trying to build a house with a rock and some sticks, you know, it was like, forget it. And, you know, the only funnels was funnel cake. So, I mean, forget it. There's no such thing as any of that stuff that we have today. So the point is that I literally had to go to a local copy shop, store that was down the street. And I said, hey guys, you know, how do you publish a book? And they said, well, you know, here, you just do this. I was like, look, I don't have any money. What's the cheapest way you can do it? They said, well, you can do tape bound. I said, what's that? It's bound with a piece of tape, tape bound. I'm like, oh, that makes sense. So, I mean, I published the ugliest book you've ever seen, self-published, you know, there's no KDP or anything, of course, back then.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called Permission to Succeed. Well, you know, so happened that I met Jack Canfield a year later, and he was in the same town that I was going to college. He went to the same college in Amherst, Massachusetts. And so I met him and showed him my self-published book, which was the ugliest book you've ever seen, but he loved it. And he totally got my message. He totally understood what I was doing. He sent my self-published book to the Chicken Soup publisher. And 8 weeks later, I got a call from the Chicken Soup publisher and they said, we'd like to publish your book. So that's mm-hmm. how I got my big break really there. But here's the funny thing about that. I swear this is true. I figured the way that happened is that, you know, I get published week one. Week two, I'm on Oprah, and week three, I'm a millionaire. That's what I figured. I swear I thought that. That didn't exactly happen that way. Not exactly how it works, you know. And so it was a hell of a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. Much, much, much harder.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I love what you're doing, Chandler. I mean, I'm a huge fan of yours. I'm a huge fan of self-publishing school. I think you're doing great work, helping so many people, you know, whether it's first-time authors or people who've authored many books. To really, really get a leg up on the competition. So, you know, that's why I'm a big fan and excited to be here today.
Oh, awesome. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. So how would you say like those first 10,000 copies, Like, what did you do? Was it, I mean, I know you talked about kind of, I feel like a lot of authors experience is like, oh, cool, I'm traditionally published. Now they're going to publish my book.
Right.
And we always tell people it's called book publisher, not book marketer.
That's right.
They're not going to market your book. You as the author, whether you're self-publishing, traditionally publishing, doesn't matter. You're responsible for selling books. 100%. So what was maybe like one or two things that worked the best? And strictly in like that first 10,000 copies.
Yeah, absolutely. I really did. I came into this business with stars in my eyes. And, you know, like I said, you know, thought I'd be a millionaire in the first week and didn't exactly happen that way. But I remember going exactly what you said. I had to learn what you just said the hard way. And, you know, I literally was like, why aren't you guys doing something to the publisher? I'm like, why aren't you doing something? You know, and they would literally do nothing. And I'd be like, hello, don't you want to sell books? And they said to me, basically what you just said, which is, well, that's up to you, dum-dum. I'm like, oh, thanks a lot. Wait, what? You know, so I had to just, I mean, it was just hustle, you know, just like Gary Vee talks about. It was just pure hustle. And I would do tons of book signings. And you know, back then, of course, things were totally different than they are right now. Frankly, the tools that we all have available as authors today are so much better. Of course, that's the good news and the bad news. The good news is that the tools are so much better. The bad news is the competition is increased by a factor of 100,000, you know, so there's just so much noise out there. It's really, really hard, much, much harder to really stand out. So the point is, the number one thing that I did and that, you know, every successful author really has to do is build an audience. You know, you have to build your email list. I know you teach that to your clients, and that's what I teach my clients as well, is you've got to build a tribe. You've got to build a tribe of people who know, like, and trust you, and you have to own that list. All right. And so I am a huge proponent of email marketing, right? There's so many people you hear, oh, email marketing is dead. Really? Okay, how's Clubhouse going for you these days? You know, I mean, whatever. There's always a shiny object. There's always a new gimmick. There's always a new fad, but there are the things that will always work. You know, look, every marketing thing, every marketing anything always decreases over time. And why? Because as my good friend Gary Vee says, marketers ruin everything. Marketers ruin everything. And that will never not change. Okay. That will never change. That will never change. That will never not be true, is what I meant to say. My point is that, so just, you know, I remember in the 90s, right, when I started, I mean, you know, email open rates were what, 70, 80%, you know? Well, now you're lucky to get what, 12%, 15%, you know, whatever. So, I mean, everything stops work, or I should say decreases over time. And of course, we know with advertising, the costs go up and the conversions go down.
Right.
Look at Facebook, look at TikTok, look at whatever you want, you know. So whenever anything starts, and, you know, my good friend and our mutual friend Rich Sheffern talks about this all the time, you know, that at the beginning of any, you know, marketing tactic, it's really, really good because it's new. But then marketers come in, they ruin everything, and then it stops working. So I will just reiterate that I don't know of any other strategy that is more important than building an email list of people who know, like, and trust you as an author. That way, whatever you choose to put out, you know, if you put out one book, five books, 10 books, or in my case, 22 books, you know, you have a warm, receptive audience that says, hey, what do you got now? And I can't wait to read it.
That's good. And so it's a good lesson for people. Hey, marketers ruin everything. Early days of a new fad or marketing channel might be good, but they're going to diminish and stick to the tried and true. You mentioned book signing. So I'm sure there was some in-person stuff, some speaking stuff. And then long-term, it sounds like the big takeaway is invest in your email list. And it's an owned asset, not a borrowed asset. You're kind of on your own playground versus playing on somebody else's playground. And when you're playing somebody else's playground, the rules to that playground could change. The playground can close down. There's a lot of kind of unknown variables. Talk to me about, you know, 22 books. I feel like a lot of times as authors, like you've got one or two books that just really hit. And from a bunch of people I've interviewed on this podcast, it's like, there's no, you know, it's like, well, why? Like, why do you think? And a lot of times there's no rhyme or reason, but, you know, screw it. I'll ask it anyway. For you, like, which of the 22 books has sold the best? And any rhyme or reason or kind of why behind that as you can understand it?
Well, I don't have the exact numbers, but I'm going to guess, and I'm pretty sure this is true. And if you go on Amazon and just look at the, you know, like the number of reviews, you know, five-star reviews that I have, this is actually my most popular book. It's called The Book of Affirmations, and this was published by Hay House. Mm-hmm. Now, I had a dream to be published by Hay House because in the 1990s, the early 90s, before I ever wrote a book, I was going back to the library, you know, I was in the library, just, you know, grew up in the library, spent lots and lots of time in the library, hours and hours and years, really. And one of my dreams was to be a Hay House author. And the reason is because I read lots of Hay House books, right? The Spiritual Growth, they're the number one self-help publisher in the world. Louise Hay, Marianne Williamson, you know, Deepak Chopra, you know, just the biggest names in the self-help spiritual world, which I was really immersed in. And so after I, in 1997, when I really discovered things that were missing in this industry, I'm talking about the self-help industry now, in the personal growth industry, because I had immersed myself in that environment and reading all those books and studying all these guys, and I went, okay, what's missing? What aren't they telling us? And I think that's an important lesson because for any author, the one thing you don't want to do is just, you know, be a me too, be a recycle, be a regurgitation of everybody else. And you see that everywhere. I mean, everywhere is just guys and gals who are just saying the same thing that everybody else does. And it's like boring. You know, it's just, oh my God, we've heard this a million times and you're boring. You know, and the one thing you can't do is bore people because that way, or if you do, you're never going to get their attention. And so I discovered something, you know, totally new and unique in the field of self-help, which is my method of affirmations. You'll notice this is spelled A-F-F-O-R-M-A-T-I-O-N-S, affirmations, not affirmations. So, of course, every self-help book ever written talks about affirmations. Well, I invented this method called affirmations. And Reed Tracy, who's the CEO of Hay House, one of the most respected, you know, people in the entire publishing industry, he called me one day and he said, hey, Noah, we'd like to publish your book of affirmations. You'll notice that this is the fourth edition. I know it's hard to see there, but anyways, this is the fourth edition. So I actually published three editions of this book before the Hay House edition because I just wanted to get my message out, you know, to the world. And so when Hay House published it, I mean, you know, Hay House is Hay House. I mean, they're you know, the 800-pound gorilla. And so, you know, for the rest of my life, I can say I'm a Hay House author. And what's so funny is a lot of my friends, as a result, they decided to be Hay House author. A lot of my, you know, colleagues in the industry, they saw me doing it. And they're like, hey, I want to be a Hay House author. So they did. And it's like, you're welcome. You know, yeah. But anyway, so that one really, I think people absolutely love for a very simple reason, because this works. It is mm-hmm. incredibly powerful mm-hmm. and incredibly simple and frankly, incredibly life-changing. So mm-hmm. just for the fact of the quality of the work, that is really what has sold many copies of the book. I would say the second one is called Power Habits. This is mm-hmm. Was published by Nightingale Conant, who is a traditional audiobook publisher. Well, the CEO of Nightingale Conant, Vic Conant, called me one day a few years ago and he said, hey, Noah, we're going to get into the book publishing industry now because they've been doing audio only for, you know, 50 years. And I had done two programs with them. I've done two audio programs with Nightingale Conant, and it was the Power Habits system and the Power Habits of Ultimate Self-Confidence. So I talked about, anyway, the Power Habits of Unconsciously Successful People. So what I realized is that the affirmations book is part of the Power Habits. So in other words, I created this system. And again, I'm showing you part of the book here on page 100, you'll see affirmations is part of the system. So the way that I did this is I designed this book to be really a workbook, you know, a template, a guide for people who had studied lots of self-help and had spent lots of money and gone to all these seminars, but they were still stuck. And so that's why you mentioned, you know, in your introduction that I'm known for helping my clients make more in 12 weeks than they did in the previous 12 months. Well, that's really how I do it. So I laid it out in the book.
It's the Power Habits.
And people, yes, and people really, really love it. And that's, you know, why they gravitate to it.
Got it. Lots to unpack there. Two kind of veins of thoughts.
Yes.
One is, so you talked about that selling the best with Hay House. Was that something that Hay House did? Were you still largely responsible for marketing the book? Like,
I know it was me. It was me. Yeah. It was me. I love Hay House, but man, it was me. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It was, I don't want to say it was all me, but it was all me.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, but you know, again, with Hay House being the 800-pound gorilla, I can walk into any room, anything, and anybody
it helps
knows
open
anything.
Doors. Yeah, it,
exactly.
It cracks
anybody
open doors
knows anything.
That you can then push open.
Exactly. Yeah. You're a Hay House author? Okay, you know, come on in, you know. And so yeah, it does carry a lot of weight.
Makes sense. So talk to me about what's the difference between affirmations and afformations?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one of the things that I discovered way back in 1997, over 25 years ago. So an affirmation, as we all know, if you've ever read a self-help book, they all say the same thing, right? Say these statements, a positive statement, blah, blah, blah. You know, like for example, as a keynote speaker, you know, I'm a coach, I'm a keynote speaker and an author. And as a keynote speaker, I like to play a game with my audience members. I say, okay, everybody, we're going to stand up and say a traditional affirmation, just like those guys, you know, have been teaching us for decades. All right, everybody say, I am rich. And everybody goes, I am rich. You know what happens next? Everybody starts laughing. And I go, what are you laughing at? And they go, well, I'm not rich. And I say, but you just said you were. And they go, yeah, but I don't believe it. And see, that's the thing. We say these positive statements, but we just don't really believe it. We're like bashing into our brain. In fact, interestingly, a study was done about this very topic, and it found that 75% of people who use the old affirmations method end up more frustrated than before. So imagine if you had a smartphone, right? Imagine you had a smartphone and it didn't work 3 out of the 4 times you tried to use it, right? You'd probably get a new phone. So that's what I invented. I invented a better phone, which is your brain, right? So how to use your brain. So an affirmation, you know, again, this method that I invented is an empowering question. So the human brain actually responds automatically to questions. It's called the embedded presupposition factor of the brain. It's just a fancy way of saying when you ask a question, your brain searches for the answer. And so I said, why are we going around making statements we don't believe when the human mind responds automatically to questions? And so that's what affirmations is. So, and by the way, this word affirmations that I invented comes from the Latin word formare, which means to form or give shape to. So the question I often ask my audience members or my coaching clients, whether it's one-on-one coaching or group coaching, I'll often say to them, what if you're making something firm, but it's in the wrong form? That means you form the life you didn't even want. And you do that through the power of your questions. So using my affirmations method, you can take conscious control of the questions you're asking, change your questions, change your habits, change your results, and thereby change your life.
Mm. And so give me an example of an author affirmation. So let's say I want to sell more books. Yeah. I want to sell more copies of my book. Right. Well, maybe how would I do that in the traditional affirmation model?
Right.
And then how would that be different? And what's an example of doing that in the affirmation model?
Right. So an affirmation would be, I'm a successful author, or, you know, it's easy for me to sell a lot of books, right? Those are statements. And you're like, your brain goes, no, you're not. Right. No, it isn't. That sounds stupid. Right. I call it the yeah, right response. Your brain goes, yeah, right. Right. We say the statement, we want to believe it, but we just don't. So in affirmation, you bypass the yeah, right response using the embedded presupposition factor of the brain. You'd say, why am I such a successful author? Why is it so easy for me to sell lots of copies of my books? Now your brain goes, what? But see, because you're asking a question, you actually don't hit your brain. And so it's like you, instead of hitting a brick wall, you take a left, and your brain figures out a way to do it. Now, it's not magic, right? What I teach you in my books and my coaching and my courses is, you know, this isn't magic. What they taught you in The Secret, right? We all saw The Secret. And they say, if you think about money, you know, it just pours in from the sky. Think about a car and it magically shows up. Really? What planet's that on again? You know, because I'd move to that planet tomorrow where you don't have to do anything, right? Just think about money and it just appears.
Just
on
manifest.
Planet Earth, we have to do this annoying thing called take action if we want results. So that's what I teach. But it's the foundation, going back to my power habits I was talking about, it's the foundation of everything that you do to get better results.
I see. So you look at it as ask the question, and then the question creates the tension that defaults your brain towards, okay, what are the actions that I need to
Correct.
Take versus just tension that's, all right, well, I'm not that person.
I can't
so
do it.
Fill in right. the blank, but it's like almost sounds like a more practical action oriented way.
Yes, indeed. And if you go to my website, you'll see, I mean, just hundreds of stories of examples of this, of people who, you know, change their questions, change their habits, change the results and change their lives. And I mean, I could tell you tons of stories about that, but anyway.
That's so. Really interesting, because I feel like what you've done there was just super smart marketing wise, uh-huh. is you've kind of picked a big mainstream thing that a lot of people were bought into. And then you've kind of done an us versus them.
That's like, right.
Okay, here's why this is wrong. That's here's right. why everything you know about affirmations.
That's right.
is wrong, and here's what to do instead. Was right. that was that intentional? Was that kind of like, did you kind of stumble into that? What was kind of the why behind that? And is there anywhere else in your business where you've done that? In your business or with your books where you feel like you've done that successfully?
I've always done that, but it was never from a marketing standpoint. I wish I was as good a marketer, you know, as a lot of these guys out there, because I would have done it a lot smarter and a lot better a lot earlier. So I had to catch up with myself because I discovered affirmations in April of 1997. I discovered Power Habits in October of 1997. All of everything that I've done is an us versus them, or here's what they're not telling us. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to, I mean, that's what I say, because mm-hmm. they just don't tell us. I mean, so going back to my, you know, my Power Habits system, the full title is The Power Habits of Unconsciously Successful People, meaning what highly successful people do unconsciously that they don't even know they're doing, number one. Therefore, number two, they can't teach you. That's mm-hmm. why, you know, people, like, there was one client who had spent tens of thousands of dollars on all these different, you know, self-help. And that's really mostly who I work with. People who have spent lots and lots of money and they're still stuck. They hit that, as I call it, the income ceiling. They keep hitting an income ceiling and nothing that they're doing is helping them. I'm saying that's because they left everything out. And we actually helped them increase by 600% in less than 1 year. So just hockey stick growth, like, whoop, you know, right through.
And how'd you do that?
Because of these power habits. They're unconscious habits that these people are doing that they're never going to tell you.
So what are the power habits?
Well, that's what I mean. That's why affirmations is the first one.
I see.
Highly success. That's, again, it goes back to the system. So this is a lot like Stephen Covey's, you know, 7 Habits of Highly mm-hmm. Effective People. You mm-hmm. notice that we did a framework. And by the way, that's a really good example for every author. You want to have a framework. So you're not just saying, hey, do this.
Yes.
And it's just a bunch of tactics. And the person's like, well, what? You know, I don't get it. You know, but when you give them a framework, you're literally changing their thought patterns mm-hmm. and their behavior. That's what I've done. Again, I did all of this without knowing what I was doing. And it took me a long time for my marketing to catch up with the content. Usually it's the other way around. But for me, that's what it was. So I'm like, oh, that's actually really good. I should mm-hmm. do an us versus them. Great idea.
When the frameworks help people attribute it back to you.
That's right.
So, this is a huge, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Noah. Like this is a huge thing I messed up with a lot of my early books, is I would teach great content, but not take that extra like 5% of time to say, hey, how does this come into a framework? And so like that's with my newest book published, this was, it's like, okay, the 4 P's of a best-selling book. Right. The more writing method, which was like, it was a process that I taught for years, but then everyone rips it off and no one gives it to me because there's no framework. There's no process. Right. And so I love that you mentioned that. Take that extra time, crystallize the framework. It'll help people learn better. It'll help people implement better. And it'll be real estate that you own. Kind of like, you know, I noticed that you've been intentional about doing registered trademarks on, you know, affirmations and the book of affirmations and stuff like that. Which is smart. So going back to those power habits, and this will kind of circle to the loop I opened at the beginning of the podcast of, okay, you know, someone making more in 12 weeks than they did in 12 months. So you said, hey, power habit number one is the law or the art or whatever of affirmations.
Yep.
So that's number one. What's one or two of the other power habits that are most helpful for people looking to kind of exponentially increase their income?
Well, one is really, as I call it, taking out your head trash. So the head trash is the voice in your head that says, I can't do it because, all right? And so when you say, I can't do it because, you make yourself right, even if it's totally wrong. So we convince ourselves that we can't do things, and then we behave to make ourselves right. So one of the power habits is understanding, number one, what is your head trash? What is that voice in your head that says, I can't do it because? And then number two, understand that you don't have to keep listening to that person, that guy in your head that says, mm-hmm. I can't do it because, you know, so what many people say is, well, I can't do it because I'm too old, because I made too many mistakes, because I'm divorced, because I'm a woman, because I'm, you know, whatever. And they give every excuse in the book. And yet you can point to a person in that exact situation who's gone on to great success. And so you want to understand that just because you're telling yourself you can't do it, that doesn't make it true. I'll give you an example of that. We have one of, so like we have a program called the 12 week breakthrough, where we help people make more than 12 weeks than in the past 12 months. And the point is, you can learn about that on our website. But my point is that we had one woman from Arizona. She's an entrepreneur, and she had exactly what I was describing. She was a self-help junkie, you know, going, and that's her words. You know, she was going to all these seminars and, you know, running around and spending all this money, but she kept hitting that income ceiling. And so I taught her about affirmations and head trash and, you know, getting her foot off the brake, as I call it, and all these different, the power habits. Well, she tripled her investment in 2 weeks. She tripled in 2 weeks, and we hadn't even gotten to the money part yet. That's how powerful these unconscious habits are. Not only that, she decided to really face her fears, and she decided to actually enter a bikini contest for the first time. And she came in third place. Well, guess what? She's 69 years old, and she entered a bikini contest for the first time. I mean, she's in amazing shape, but how about that for taking out your head trash? You know, 69 years old, entering your first bikini contest. I mean, to me, that's really amazing.
That's wild. I love that, the concept of taking your foot off the brake. I think this is a great analogy. Yep. So I want to talk a little bit about your publishing experience. So obviously you've self-published. Yep. You've also worked with HarperCollins. You worked with Hay House. You worked with Simon & Schuster. You've published with Mindvalley. You've published with Nightingale Conant. You've published with the Chicken Soup for the Soul publisher. So one of the more diverse publishing experiences, you know, people that we've had on the show. So I guess with that in mind, which was the best experience between all those? And then what were maybe some comparisons? And, you know, obviously, you know, this is no knock on any of these publishers or whatever, but I'd love for you to speak as freely as you can of just like, hey, this was the best experience. Here's just so people can kind of come in with eyes wide open, depending on which route, which publisher they pick.
Well, I am actually the only author in history to be published by those six publishers that you mentioned. No one else in the history of publishing has ever done that. Been published by Hay House, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, Mindvalley, Nightingale Conant, and Chicken Soup for the Soul publisher. Nobody's done it. Tony Robbins hasn't done it. You know, Deepak, no name that you can name has done it other than me. So I'm the only person in history that's ever done that. And so I do have a very wide range of experience in both self-publishing and traditional publishing. In fact, we have a book done for you service as well. I'm working with a stem cell doctor right now because he said, no, I've got this book rattling around in my head. I've had it rattling around for years, but you know, I see what you're doing and, you know, can you help me? And so, yes, I mean, so we have that service as well. We get books done. In fact, we decided to co-author it because, you know, he's like, no, I want your name on this too. So we have that service too. So what I would say is I actually put all traditional publishers basically, you know, in the same pile. And they're all great. And they have very severe limitations. So here's how I describe it. It's very simple. When you do self-publishing, you do all the work and you keep all the money. When you do traditional publishing, you do all the work and they keep most of the money. And people say, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why would I do that? Mm-hmm. The answer is for one word. And the one word is distribution. That is what traditional publishers can give you that you, I don't want to say you can't do it, but it's freaking hard. Mm-hmm. Okay. In other words, you know, Hay House, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, they have armies of salespeople all around the world. So that's how I've been published in 18 languages, as I was showing you before. If I would have had to do this, I probably wouldn't have done it. It's a hell of work. And so they have these armies of salespeople. And also they have people who want to sell your books in other languages. Right? Because they make money when they sell the rights. So, you know, I'm in Hungarian and Chinese and Japanese and French and Portuguese and on and on and on. Right? So the publisher makes money and I make money. So the point is that distribution is worth a lot. Again, going back to my point that I made earlier, you know, being able to say that I'm a Hay House author, I'm a HarperCollins, and I'm the only author in history to be published by the big six publishers. Again, that carries some weight, you know, to some in some audiences, in some circles, people go, wow, okay, that's pretty cool. And of course, it does help me get clients because they know, hey, I've done it. I've done it all different ways. I know the ins and outs of this industry. I've been doing it 25 years. I can show you the mistakes to avoid, mistakes I wish someone had told me to avoid, you know, many years ago, and how to get it done very, very quickly. So like with that book, Done For You Service, I mean, we get it done in, you know, 4 to 8 weeks instead of taking years and years and years that the person, you know, would normally do. We had just a real quick story. This is funny. I had one client and she said, no, I want to publish a book. And I said, okay, no problem. So where we always start is, well, you know, first of all, do you have a book? You know, is it done? Do you have a manuscript? Mm-hmm. She said, oh yeah, I've got a manuscript. Okay, great. By the way, so where is your manuscript? She says, well, it's in a shoebox in my closet. Okay. I'm just curious. I asked her, I said, so I'm curious. So how long has it been in a shoebox in your closet? She said, 15 years. I said, okay, well, yeah. Do you see? Head trash, fear, keeping her stuck. I said, maybe we want to get it out of the shoebox, out of the closet, and maybe we could share it with the world. So, you know, just helping her to get her that self-confidence that she could do it. And now she's actually published many books. So, I mean, just getting her over that hurdle was worth, well, it was priceless.
Cool. Well, no, this has been great, man. Talk to me, last question. Knowing what you know now, 22 books later, what would be your parting piece of advice for the Noah from 22 years ago? Or not 22 years ago, how many ever years ago and 22 books ago, what would be your parting piece of advice?
Get help and do your research. I spent over $750,000 paying all these marketing gurus only to find out they can't teach their way out of a paper bag. They truly suck at teaching. They're great self-promoters, but there's no there. There's nothing there. And so that really sucked. It really, you know, it cost me years and cost me a lot of money and it hurt my self-confidence. So the point for everybody watching and listening to the program is, you know, do get help. It's really hard. I mean, there's a lot of ins and outs. There's things you don't know. It's like climbing Mount Everest. You want a Sherpa, you know, you want somebody who's been to the mountaintop, right? To help you get there and not fall and you know, hurt yourself. So I wish I would have had better advice, you know, much, much earlier, because I got a lot of bad advice and that really, really cost me. So be careful of the people who are really, you know, great at self-promotion, but do your homework and see, have they helped other people succeed? Have they helped other people get results? Not just about them. When it's just about them, you know, then it's like, it's personality driven success, as I call it. There's a big difference between personality driven and system-driven success. You want to find a coach, a mentor who's got a system, and that's who you work with, because that way it can work for anybody.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Noah, thank you so much, man. This has been awesome. Where can people go to find out more about you and buy your books and all that good stuff?
My main website is noahstjohn.com. That's my name, just like it sounds, N-O-A-H-S-T-J-O-H-N. You go to afformations.com, learn more about that. And by the way, if you go to breakthroughwithnoah.com, that's a new site we have, breakthroughwithnoah.com. And there's an 11-minute training video on how I help my clients make more than 12 weeks than in the previous 12 months at breakthroughwithnoah.com. By the way, I want to, real quick, we didn't even get to mention this, but my new book is The 7-Figure Expert. And that I don't even have it to show in my hands. I mean, that's how new it is. But it's 7figureexpertbook.com. That is free plus shipping. So if you want to check that out, 7figureexpertbook.com and breakthroughwithnoah.com. Those would be the two places I think would be great to start.
Awesome. You said 7figureexpertbook.com?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Awesome. 7figureexpertbook.com. That's the new book. Check it out, y'all. Noah, thank you so much, man. Appreciate you.
My pleasure.
I learned from Gary Vaynerchuk this idea of one is greater than zero. And even though my platform is a decent size and I have, you know, I should be selective of some opportunities, when it comes to sharing, to define what that is, Gary took a year. Gary Vaynerchuk, very busy running companies. He took a year where he went on a podcast a day. Obviously, there's a lot of demand for his time, but he went on a podcast a day as a way to also give back to his audience or anyone that would ask. So he went on to 365 podcasts and he wasn't filtering by, oh, are they big enough or they whatever. And one of his rebukes to his audience and entrepreneurs in general was like, who do you think you are? He's like, I'll go on a podcast with two people, with five listeners, because one is greater than zero. You don't know who those listeners are. And that listener might also be the decision maker, might be the CMO at some company, might be friends of a friend that gets exposed to your book, your idea, your thing. So one is greater than zero. And if you could be on any shows at all. So that was sort of while we've also tried to get on whatever, I generally took as many actions as possible to guest on shows. And even hired somebody, you know, depending on the entrepreneurs listening, it was cool because her dream was to be in ministry and to work at a church. That's what she's doing now. But hired somebody, it was kind of, we ended up just finding and putting her in that spot, but we kind of created the quote unquote PR role at our company for somebody that would be like a lower level. They didn't come in necessarily with expertise, put them through your side. Literally was like, study everything Chandler's ever done, every marketing tip, log in, get all the stuff and like do that. And was sort of more of like, if you will, an intern, paid intern level, because this person didn't come in with any experience, but found someone to say, here's the vision, study Pete Vargas's stuff, study this stuff. And these are the types of things we want to do. Look for those quote unquote PR opportunities, not like traditional media, but that's fine too. But like the whole guest podcasting, email, look through our DMs, look through people who follows, you know, and putting someone on that to hustle. And again, it was not consolidated to like a launch week or even a month, but it really has been just kind of slow and steady over probably the last year.
Hmm. That's good. And that's encouraging, I think, for people who maybe feel like they failed their launch or maybe you don't have what it takes to do a big launch. Is Sean saying, hey, look, I feel like I failed both of my launches, but it's the continuous day in, day out stuff that's moved the needle. And it's funny, even just reflecting on the timelines that when you're doing the, when you were saying, talking about how old your kids are, I'm doing the back of the napkin math over here. And I'm like, well, hold up. It feels like you had a kid basically at the time of both of your book launches. It's like, I guess your kid probably came a little bit after the most recent one. And then 2.5, 3 years before that would have been the launch of the first one. So it's like, hey, you can do this when you got a lot of stuff going on.
I think giving yourself grace. I love grace-based productivity. You know, not making an excuse. Like we got to bite the bullet, eat the frog, get up, do the work. But we also could be just be so hard on ourselves and being realistic about the season you're in and forgiving yourself or giving yourself grace that like, again, who cares if you miss the week? This is about the journey. So rest, hang out with your kid, hang out with your family, take some time off, but then circle back and suck it up. And you do have some time and you have recovered and like, and what's exciting about that is I also, one of the most important things in marketing, and I'm very passionate about this across the board, is people overestimate how much attention people are paying or thinking their message is getting through. People overestimate, they posted an Instagram reel and got 22,000 views and they're like, I'm rich, I'm a viral sensation. But even like, what does 22,000 views mean on Instagram reels? If you look at the audience retention curve, a lot of times it just tanks. And then 10% of people watch the rest of the reel. They watch the preview, which is amazing because that means 2,200 people watched your entire Instagram reel, but not 22,000. But what I'm getting at is like the mistake I think 99% of authors make is they think they're talking about their book too much. And I'm saying you're talking about it way too little. So if we were to do, and I'm actually just like talking to myself into this, if we were to launch the second edition of YouTube in a launch week, as if it just came out, I think another thing that's interesting is people, I think they get too afraid of using the word new. They think it's only new 7 days after the book comes out. No, this is still new. This is still a brand new book. It's still new. It's a year old, but no, it's still brand new. Mm-hmm. You know, people in marketing, they're like, oh, it's all, no, it's still new. And people love new. So you should use the word new. Think about toothpaste. Like marketers understand this. You look at Colgate and it says new and improved. No, it's the same. It's been same toothpaste from 30 years ago. There's no innovations in toothpaste. They're still putting the word new on it. Why? And by the way, new and improved, there's no way it could be both of those things. If it's improved, then that means it's old. But what can we learn from Colgate? That new and improved is good marketing because you're at Target and you're like, oh, it's new and improved. It's a new formula. And the reason it's a new formula is because they added charcoal because that's the trend, but it doesn't actually even really do anything. And ultimately, they found a way. So our book is an updated second edition. It's new and revised, But the other key thing about new is 99.9% of the world, more than that, like, has never heard of you. So by launching, you're trying to build a critical mass, you're building groundswell. Some, you have new followers, you have new subscribers, you've got 10 more people, 100 more people on your email list. And by asking them maybe to share and following your street team formula and all this different stuff, I'm like, why don't I just do a launch week again? YouTube Secret Second Edition is out now. Launching yeah. this week. And why is it launching? Because we'll do a Gleam.io giveaway, which is a giveaway platform. Like, so there's no, why not throw another party? Why not throw another launch party? What could be new about it? Give away a PDF bonus chapter. And that's the new thing. So anyways, the takeaway is like, keep launching knowing that the average people haven't heard. And you might think that even your Instagram followers, I might think that people who follow me on Facebook or your Facebook friends know that you launched a book. Here's, I think, the critical mindset. Assume that nobody knows, they have not heard, they're not paying attention. Because the empathetic thing to know about is, though, even though you thought you talked about it so much in a week or for a month, is they were on vacation, they were very busy, it went through their feed, they kind of noticed, but they forgot, they got distracted, they were on their computer and they did actually want to buy your book, but then their toddler ran in, knocked up a cup of hot coffee on their crotch, now he has permanent damage, he may not be able to have more kids. Like, stuff is happening in people's lives. So you need to be a lot louder and talk about your stuff more and never let the one comment, because it's only one. There's one comment that's like, oh, you've been talking about your book so much. But you kind of have to ignore that, because look at the like count. Like the like count, people were like, oh, I didn't even know this was out. So you have like seven comments. Mm-hmm. They're like, this is so cool, I'd love to order this. But one person's like, you just promote your book too much. You really have to silence that voice, because perhaps, and then I like to thank that person. Thank you for paying so much attention. Oh, I appreciate you. Clearly, you actually are really here, and I thank you for the feedback. I just want to make sure people haven't heard about it. 99% of your followers and email list subscribers, you've been in junk and spam. You didn't even realize it. Like, you're not in their main inbox. So it is your responsibility to keep talking about it.
Man, I could not agree more. And we're so aligned on that philosophy of just, it's so funny because I do the same thing. It's like, new book. This is my new book. It's new until I publish another one. Uh-huh. It's my new book. and so, I mean, keep talking about it, keep marketing it. Let's talk about kind of evergreen marketing. I know when you were on the show last time, you said, hey, we're selling about 2,000 books a month. I want to say it was like 900 or 1,000 of those were audiobooks. So it was about 50-50 audiobook and other formats. What have been the one or two top selling, maybe since then, things that have moved the most copies of your book?
Well, I would love to say that we can track good attribution.
Right.
What I can say is, okay, so this in June of 2023, we sold 912 physical books, 379 ebooks, and 690 audiobooks. So physical was the highest. And I would probably point us back to a podcast is powerful. If you can create value in your past library, any content is powerful. So any content that adds value and gives a call to action is powerful. And if that content has a shelf life. So this is why I would encourage listeners to be very thoughtful, specifically about probably two things. One, you're the expert in this, SEO, written content that ranks, that can bring you traffic and awareness. I'd be the expert in understanding that SEO on YouTube, content that ranks, that can continue to be viewed for weeks, months, and years to come. Because if you have either of those things, that just means that you created a piece of content one time, a blog post, what I would argue is a ranked YouTube video. We teach a particular way of doing that. And that video now is being viewed for weeks, months, years to come. And the more times you do it, you've duplicated yourself. It's like your Star Wars clone army. I only can do so much, and I'm trying to be there for my wife, be there for my kids, be there for my business. But man, it's so leveraged. It says it on your wall, leverage plus impact. Like, I love leverage. Like, it's so leveraged to have content. And so we also have, one of my favorite things is we just bought a URL called tubesecretsaudio.com, which just bought it on GoDaddy and redirected it to the Amazon page where you could either just, if you're already an Audible user, Audible page, I should say, it says get it free, you know, grab the book free. The commissions on that back in the day, it's gone down. Back in the day, it was as much as $15 if you just got someone to sign up for Audible.
Right.
I think it's $5 or maybe $5 or $10. It depends, even if whether they stick with it or not. And they're just paying you for that person to sign up. So, and then you actually maybe get, I think, a little bit less if they just use a credit. And then, of course, they could also purchase it. Anyways, so when I would sponsor my own video podcast or YouTube video, like, hey, by the way, if you want to get a free copy of YouTube Secrets on audio, just go to tubesecretsaudio.com. No matter where that is, that could be, if it's viewed continually, then you're truly getting passive sales of your book. And then the other cool thing is you also can do it not just evergreen. Even if only 10 people watch your Instagram stories or Facebook stories, like, if you haven't talked about your book in a while, like, talk about it, you know, and hey, by the way, and either some people, you know, there's a way to do clickable links, but you need a certain number of followers. One of my good friends, Shalene Johnson, talks about curiosity marketing. She said even linking to stuff on stories is not best practice. Best practice is getting someone to DM you. And so she'd call it curiosity marketing, where you're even less selling. Like, you're not pushing anything and saying, click the link. You're maybe saying, you know, hey, my book's out. I actually talk about this particular thing. It's in chapter 7. Anyways, DM me if you're like interested in that. And like something like that. And then you get the person that's engaged. And then in the DMs, you could personally share with them the link. Her point is this, by far, and they've tracked it. If you just say, hey, like kind of passively, like swipe up or like click the link to go get it, you get one click or three clicks or 30 clicks, depending on your following. But like, if you engage people and you create some curiosity, and you create an autoresponder. You could program autoresponders in your smartphone that like you just start typing and it's like, hey, and you could just manually, you might be able to send out 7 to 10 manual messages, but even the conversion of that is 10x higher because there's a personal conversation. And maybe you talk back and forth with the person like, oh, this is so cool, I'm going to buy your book right now. Whereas just because someone clicked the link, they land on Amazon, check it out. Oh, they get distracted. So anyways, it would be both. In terms of sales would be, yes, when possible, I do those weekly actions like discipline, if I can, to share on my social media with a post that'll be buried in a couple months. But the absolute game changer is leaning into leveraged content. Mm-hmm. Written content like you teach in blogs, you know, video content like I would teach. I want to create a video. And
the discipline forever. Of...
Yeah, that lasts forever.
Yeah.
And the discipline is like, not every one of my videos ranks, but just think it's also a law of averages. If I create 100 YouTube videos, one a week over 2 years, 5 to 10 of those will break out. And that's like everybody's math. It's at different levels, but like it's just kind of the Pareto principle. Some of those you didn't even know why it worked, but it did. You're like, there's this one video on my YouTube library that just keeps getting views. You're just going to be really grateful when you wove in a call to action to your book, because that's how you've truly created passive sales. So it takes on a life of its own.
Yeah. And and you do such a great job of this. I mean, like, even I feel like I've seen when I'm searching for my own name on YouTube, it's like Sean Cannell, like an interview that we did, or I think at one point it was How to Write a Book. And your interview with me was ranking for that. So just like that evergreen stuff that's showing up on an ongoing basis. We're running out of time here. I got a couple final questions. One is, you've got over 3,100 ratings and reviews on your book. And then what's actually might be more impressive is over 1,100 reviews on the audiobook, which audiobook reviews are super hard to get. Because, you know, you and I think, oh, everyone's got Audible, right? Like everyone has that. And I remember being in a car full of people who I consider to be, you know, very smart and motivated and all that stuff. I'm like, hey, how many of you guys have Audible? It was like one person raised their hand. I'm like, oh, got it. Okay. This is like not as many people have this as I think. And so I think that's really impressive. All that to say, how have you gotten so many reviews on your book? And is there anything you've done intentionally that's worked to either get reviews on the physical book or the audio book?
Yeah, I think that the best call to action I've ever heard audiobook wise was in Alex Hormozi, $100 million offers, his first book. And that's what, when I first got it, I wouldn't have been able to point him out in a room. There was kind of just word of mouth. And I think, and I also, I prefer physical books, but I find myself bouncing a baby or, you know, doing chores. So I end up a lot of times I'll get both because the book's just sitting there and I'm like, I want to start it. So I get the audiobook. And, he added value first, and mid book, he just gave kind of just a heartfelt, like if you've already learned something. And it was, that's, I think, kind of the key is like mid book. It wasn't necessarily end and it wasn't necessarily beginning, although all three would probably be fine. Hey, by the way, it'd mean the world or whatever. So that was also another reason. Of course, we continue to learn and absorb since the first edition. So by the second edition, we try to be more thoughtful of giving a heartfelt, and I think maybe the tone here, there's something about not just being like kind of like pushy or shouty, like, hey, just go review it. Also not underdoing it. Like, so giving it an adequate time to sort of bring your timbre down, your cadence down, and be like, hey, listen, you know, one of the things that is super meaningful to me as an author that just wants, you know, to add value, but it'll help other expand this message would be if you left a review. Now I know that it might even seem like a hassle, but it only takes about a minute and even potentially educating a little bit how to do it. You know, if you just log into your auto, if you just open up your Audible app, hit the star count and leave a few words, it'll take less than a minute, but it'll go a long way. And if you know, our audiobook is only on Audible. So if you can articulate, this is similar to getting like a podcast review, I would say is, and Michael Stelzner actually described that to me. He years ago when he's talking about podcast reviews, he's just like, slow down, you know, acknowledge the listener, articulate the details, don't be condescending, but assume they don't know how to do it or they've never done it before, or give it some time and then keep going. So I think that would be the one thing in terms of the audiobooks. And then I think the other thing I would say, I was in a discussion with others about this, is give yourself some grace on your reviews. I know your tactics are much better than mine and everything you teach inside of your program and stuff, but like, it's also just the math. I mean, 110,000 copies across the whole deal, and you know, a little less than 1%. Well, I guess on audiobooks, maybe it's 2% reviewed or 1% reviewed or something like that. And so it's also just the math. So I think if the math is maybe too low, what do you have a percentage that you would think? Like, what do you think books sold versus?
I don't have a great percentage, but I agree with you. It's very low. And you just think, hey, everyone would leave a review. But then if you also think, okay, what are the last 50 books I read personally? How many of those did I leave a review on?
I'm the worst. I'm the worst with my friends too. I'm actually now like, I'm guilty because it's bringing it top of mind of I'd finish up with somebody and I'm like, what's the one thing? And they're like, yeah, the one thing you could do for me is like leave a review. Dr. Andrea Ferland literally asked me that. And I'm sitting here, I'm like, I never did it. I need to. And so, yeah. Yeah. And so I think that it's understanding that it's kind of probably a math thing and writing yep.
Right. Yeah. Well, kind of transitioning to the final questions here. And guys, Sean and I did a training together on how to write and publish a book. You can access that training, register for it, go to startyourbook.live. Okay, startyourbook.live. When you register for the training, you'll also get a free digital copy of my book published. And in that training, we go a lot more in depth on how to write and publish a book. So if you want to check out that training, go to startyourbook.live. Sean, what would you say your parting piece of advice is, knowing what you know now, for the person who specifically is thinking about relaunching or republishing their book?
I would say you can heal from your trauma. The trauma, I think that when you finish your first book, now, if you work with Chandler Bolt and the team, maybe you didn't, then you maybe experienced less trauma. But here's what I, the post-traumatic stress syndrome that comes after getting a book out, you just know how much effort it took, how much emotional strength it took, how much energy it took. The path of least resistance is not doing the second edition. The path of least resistance, or and maybe, so give yourself some time to recover, you know, give yourself some time to baseline. It's going to be okay. You've done it before. You could do it again. It'll be easier the second time, but also don't underestimate it, because there might be a whole new set of challenges like you experienced as well. And so, but remember that it's worth it. And remember that the feeling that, cause I looked back and I was like, oh, the pain, do I want to go through the pain again, if you will, or just there's a lot of other things you can do. There's a lot of other things demanding your time, but once it's done, nothing like it being done and it's in your hands, not planned, not on Google Docs, not an idea, not in your planning software, not half done, but done. At some point, it's got to be shipped. It's got to be in the mail, and it's worth it. And if you've done one version, then you just know it's worth it. Just embrace it again. And I think that's that mindset piece. Prepare your mind for battle. Prepare your mind to punch the resistance in the face and do the work and lean in. And that's what I would say. It's worth it. Love and it'll be better because you learn lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And so refinement, I think, is one of the most powerful things in content creation, is the chance to refine something and make it even better.
Make it better. It's worth it. Relaunch your dang book. and you don't have to do a second edition, but do a relaunch. It's just so underutilized by authors. And I'm so glad we were able to unpack this from Sean of exactly how he did it. Sean, you're the man. Where can people go to buy a copy of your book, to find out more about what you're up to, work with you, whatever would be most helpful?
Yeah, you could go to ytsecrets.com. The book's also just on Amazon, but that's there's some cool stuff at ytsecrets.com. And Sean Cannell rhymes with YouTube channel. And you could connect at me with any social media and stuff. Would love to help. If you have any questions. And then if you want to lean into the YouTube thing and all the, you know, even just tech or get started creating content or even audio and different microphones, our channel Think Media will help you with that content creation stuff and get the tools for creating content, give you the tips as well. And so you just type in Think Media and YouTube, and it's a pretty deep rabbit hole to go down, but it'll be a lot of fun. So thank you so much, Chandler. I really appreciate you for having me on again.
Yeah, well, guys, check it out. Grab a copy of the book, YouTube Secrets. You can get a copy, like you said, at ytsecrets.com. Check out Think Media, massive YouTube channel, also great company. And they've got a lot of really good trainings. I've sent some of my team through Sean's YouTube training. It's legit. It's a big part of how we've grown a lot on YouTube. So check them out, buy the book. Sean, appreciate you, brother.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Thank you so much for watching or listening to this episode of the Self-Publishing School Podcast. I know there's so many places that you could be spending your time. There's other podcasts that you could be listening to, YouTube channels that you could be watching. So thank you so much. It means the world. Now, I want you to do three things right now if you found this episode helpful. All right, number one, I don't know if you know this, but we've got a YouTube channel. It's a companion channel to this podcast. All the video versions of the episode are on the YouTube channel. So number one, subscribe to the YouTube channel. Number two, if you're listening to this podcast, wherever, whether this is Spotify, Apple Podcasts, number two, I want you to subscribe to this podcast right now so you don't miss a future episode. And then number three, this is probably the most important, leave a review on the podcast. All right. Reviews are super important and help the podcast get discovered by other people. So number three, leave a review on the podcast. Thank you so much. I'll see you in the next episode. If you're on the fence about scheduling a publishing consultation call with my team, maybe you're not quite ready for that, I've got some free training that I think will be really helpful for you. All right, all you have to do is go to register to sign up. Go to selfpublishing.com/free training. When you do, you're also going to get a free digital copy of my new book, Published. And on that training, you're going to learn the next step, so how to implement with your book. So how to write, how to publish, how to launch successfully. So go to register right now at selfpublishing.com/free training. I'll see you there.